Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gib.
Going to start with an email that was, well, the email wasn't that short. It's just that the paraphrasing of it and the answer is short. This was from, just want to say thank you really to Robert in the Netherlands, who listened to our show that some of you might have missed because it was right in the kind of Christmas, New Year's period.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about, it was in a cave. A cave where Neanderthals ate other Neanderthals. I don't know if you can say for the pleasure of it, but they weren't in a famine. They had a choice, and they decided to do it anyway, arguably or speculatively for cultural reasons. And Robert wrote in to say, basically, where is that cave? It sounds amazing. How do I find it? Can I go there? And I wrote him back, and I'll just repeat that for everyone out there. This is the Grotte de Goyet, Goyet, mm-hmm. in Belgium. Gib fell in love with the limestone there, the blue limestone.
Yeah, and not far away is the city of Namur. Really nice place to visit.
That was not on my map before that trip.
Namur, Belgium. Namur, Belgium.
And just a reminder that they only do tours at the moment in Flemish and in French. So as English speakers, we are kind of left out for now, but they're planning some in the future.
That won't be a problem for Robert because he said he is from Breda. That's the Netherlands. And that is where my mom spent time in a number of orphanages, one of them in Breda. So when I saw that, I had to think about my mom.
Weird.
She has parents, but the Catholic Church thought that they weren't fit to parent. So she had to spend, there were a number of different stations all throughout Holland of orphanages that she was at. And Breda was one of them.
I'm glad that that's no longer the role of the any church to make that call.
I have a letter here, and I wanted to read it last week. I opened it up, and it was so long that I'm going to read it now.
You were overwhelmed.
Yeah, totally. It's from Rita. She says, "Dear Connor and Gabe, I listen every time. Your open-mindedness and thorough research, guests, as well as great topic choices are greatly appreciated. Your discussion of things to help one fall asleep reminded me of something I do most nights. I take a stroll in my head through a place I love. In my case, it is the simple Mennonite home my grandparents lived in when I was a child. As I enter the door, I try to notice every detail. I really try to be there. Soon I can see colors, and I can even smell things. The wood stove, the potatoes in the basement, the peppery smell of the red geraniums and the silver coffee tins. I often notice things I've long forgotten about. The pail of well water with a metal cup for all to use. I've explored their garden, chicken coop, where I spent hours watching the chickens, the ditch full of water where the tadpoles swam, and so on. It's an amazing tool.
I'm with her. Who wrote this?
Rita.
Rita.
It's an amazing tool that's stimulating as well as relaxing. I hope this helps someone in some small way. Thanks for reading my letter. I look forward to your next program. As always, yours truly. And then P.S., I rarely get past the kitchen before I'm asleep.
Well, we got all the way out to the ditch with the tadpoles.
Oh.
Rita, thank you for that. I felt like I was happily reading a novel.
And quick to Cindy. This was on the topic of animals, whether they can feel or think. She definitely thinks they can feel and think the way we do. And she sent us a number of videos showing animals reacting with humans, or hugging was one of them. I have never seen a turkey hugging a human being, and now I have. Thank you very much, Cindy.
Hugging? The turkey hugged back?
Well, yeah.
With its wings?
It looked like it. It looked like the wings went up in an embrace.
I will have to verify after we record that this is not an AI-generated video.
I swear it isn't.
I was just listening to a song, it must be a new one, about all of the videos AI-generated out there where you can watch, quote-unquote, bunnies or rabbits jumping on trampolines. It's an entire genre of fake video.
Hmm.
And many people have already been tricked by them. Gabe, I'm wondering if you and our listeners, one of them, I'll double check.
I'm not the kind of guy to get tricked.
We're going to stick to animals here just for a second. Gabe, I'm going to pass over a map that I've printed out for you.
Sure.
To show where the mice in this latest experiment were collected from. I think you recognize that area.
Oh, that's right near here.
Yeah, it's in our backyard.
Oh, man.
Between Cologne and Bonn, Germany, or from Bonn
now
here.
Now what happened with these mice here?
researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology, that's step one. They collected 1,000 wild mice in that stretch of land from just kind of like west of here in Bonn toward Cologne. And the question they were trying to answer is, why is it exactly that female mice seem to choose multiple male partners? You could choose one and have a litter of babies just from the one, or you could choose multiple. What is going on there? What is the evolutionary pressure?
Why do the females do this, and why do the males not do it, or what's going on?
Well, obviously the males are part of the equation.
Yeah.
So we're talking about...
Okay, so why do they choose more than... Yeah, all right.
Yeah. We're talking about polyandry, which is a female mating with multiple males for the purpose, in this case, of procreation, obviously, and then not polyamory, which is both directions, and not polygyny, I think is how it's pronounced, when it's a male mating with multiple females in order to have more offspring.
Got it.
Polyandry is what we're talking about here. And the question was, what exactly is in it for the females? Because it could be a couple things. One is that ultimately it would help the offspring survive in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with a couple things. One is just genetic diversity of the babies. The other would be, and this is a terrible aspect of the animal kingdom, that it would be less likely for the or for a male to come in and commit infanticide and to kill those offspring because, hey, those aren't mine. Yep. If they're all mixed and matched, then there's a lower chance of that. It also allows for something called the cryptic female choice to happen. This is, I was going to say the idea. It's not the idea. It's when a female's body makes a sort of chemical, physical choice, allowing certain sperm to travel and fertilize and others not, and certain fertilized eggs to be rejected or to be implanted.
Which happens automatically almost, sir.
Yeah, this is a huge area of ongoing research, but a lot of different theories, and that's what this experiment was. Why are they doing it? Why are these wild mice doing it?
Okay.
And to get there...
What did they find out?
They had four scenarios. I know that sounds a little tricky, but it's relatively easy. They had kind of one situation where all the mice in the study had a lot of food, a super abundance of food.
Yeah.
Right? Different than the wild. And then they had the wild scenario. And then they had the females in both of those scenarios. Some of them were sort of monogamous. Mm-hmm. That was 2/3 of the cases. Mm-hmm. And then 1/3 of them had multiple mates.
Got it.
And out of those four boxes, if you can visualize those four boxes, one of them stood out. And the conclusion of this paper is that if it's in a normal food environment, which has to be most of the time, right? They don't usually have superabundance. Mm-hmm. Then when a female mouse mates with multiple males, the litter is larger. That's it. That's the benefit for the females. It's a larger litter in the wild, and hence, yes, please do that. So you're increasing the odds, first of all, just numerically, of offspring survival.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, there's still, it's not quite what they were looking for or trying to prove in this paper, the idea that the biological diversity or the genetic diversity among those offspring is going to be higher, especially if you're a female mouse and you're not sure or not able to judge the genetic, I don't know, advantage of this guy versus that guy versus that guy.
It just means the more babies you're going to get, therefore
right.
They do it.
Right.
That's it.
And interestingly, in the group that had a lot of food, there was no difference in the size of the litter. So if there's a situation of abundance, then you're going to have a large litter no matter
regardless,
what.
Regardless, so then you don't have
right.
to. Okay.
But that was the conclusion of this paper. I'll give you the title of this. This is open access to everyone out there. It's called Environmental Quality Shapes the Fitness Payoffs of Multiple Paternity. And that is the reason for polyandry in female mice.
The next study we're going to talk about was not published recently. It was published at the beginning of last year, so it's a year old, but I think its relevance is very strong right now. If you have the feeling, based on anything you've seen in the last week or weeks, that society is breaking down or that the rules that you once thought were there just simply aren't there right now because of what you're seeing on the news, whether it's in Iran or in the United States or wherever, then this one here is very relevant.
I was just going to say, if you haven't felt that personally, then it means you probably have a very healthy consumption news cycle
of media.
Yeah. But I would guess that you've heard someone in your group of friends or at recent holiday events or something say, gosh, the news sure is terrible or overwhelming or something.
We're not going to comment on the news here or whether it's right or wrong. It's simply the feeling that you get when you think that society is falling apart. That has a name. It's called anomie. A-N-O-M-I-E. Not enemy.
And not anime.
And not anime, the Japanese cartoons,
right?
Essentially.
A-N-O-M-I-E.
Anomie. The feeling that the fabric of society is unraveling, that morals are no longer there, that institutions
rules are
gone, the institutions are inefficient or appear to be that way, leadership is just simply not what it should be, not what you're used to seeing,
which again,
from a leader.
Just to be clear here, what you're saying is, or what you're talking about is a subjective feeling. So
it's a feeling.
We're not talking about objective reality, but a subjective perception of the world around you.
Yeah. And what these researchers were looking into out of Germany and Norway, University of Bergen and Hamburg, they wanted to look at, or in sociology, there has been a long belief or an observation that this feeling of anomie leads to authoritarianism, but that has never been studied. And these researchers wanted to study it just to not only based on correlation, but also they wanted to see if it could be, they wanted to conduct an experiment to see if there's a causal link between anomie or the feeling of anomie and a rise in authoritarianism. And what they did was they had a two-part experiment. The first was based on survey, and that was German data. So 1,500 Germans answered questions about their feeling of anomie and whether they would support authoritarian values. The higher your feeling of anomie, for these Germans, and they were from the center right and center left. So at that point in time, these people voted for the middle Volksparteien here in Germany.
Moderates. Politically moderate people.
Perfect way to study political psychology. These people are right in the middle. The higher their feeling of anomie, the more that they thought society was breaking down, the more likely it was that they would support authoritarian values or an authoritarian leader. So there you go. There's your survey. And that's correlational. You can't really do much with that. Part two was based on U.S. data, where they made people envision a future with high anomie. So society's breaking down.
Chaos. So anarchy.
They read a vision or a vignette, as they said in the study. I love that word. They read a vignette about the world as either breaking down or completely ordered and everyone's cooperating, the leaders are exactly the way they should be. And the third vignette was about buildings.
Oh, those poor people.
Right. So they wanted to compare and see what these people thought when it came, the survey was done afterwards about their feeling of authoritarianism.
Oh, if you could generate some. Yeah.
Right. And so they led these people were split all the way, right down the middle. The ones who read about a future where society was breaking down were more willing to support an autocratic, authoritarian ruler who could fix the situation by bypassing democratic institutions.
So it doesn't matter how it happens. I want the situation brought back to normal.
I need this fixed. I want certainty. I don't want to feel powerless. And I don't want this feeling of anomie, because I want it to go away. And the way it goes away is for people like you and me, we're involved in this too, is for an autocratic, strong ruler to make it go away. That's according to the results, that's just the way we feel. So right now, what this study does, the reason, I mean, it was published a year ago, and we normally don't look at studies that aren't, you know, brand new. But I think it's important to know that this feeling has a name. It's a sociological concept, and it has been studied, and we know how it works and how it can lead from that feeling to having real consequences, that we support authoritarian rulers without even knowing why or how that happens in the head.
Yeah, and just having a word to say out loud and to know about,
yeah,
and to know that this has been researched, I think that's pretty helpful and calming. I'm not a psychologist, but I think some psychologists might agree that saying a word out loud to describe what seems like this nebulous, dark feeling inside you,
mm-hmm,
makes it, I was going to say less serious. It's not less serious. It just makes it something you can look at more calmly or
soothing. It's almost soothing, yeah. Like a solace, yeah.
Anomie. And it is nice to know that.
Yeah. And if you want to check that paper out, it's called When Lack of Control Leads to Uncertainty, Explaining the Effect of Anomie on Support for authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm. And the other question I would leave all of you with, this is me speculating entirely based on what you just said, mm-hmm. is whether historians of the future in 50 to 75 or 100 years will look back at us right now and say, of course, they were experiencing anime. They had an entirely new media landscape that confronted them daily, hourly, with stimuli and with different imagery and videos, often without context. Whereas before, and I mean this also critically, you might have read about a horrific or devastating or catastrophic event as a small paragraph in black and white in a printed piece of newspaper.
Yeah.
And which wouldn't have given you the knowledge or the emotions to even consider what actually happened there. And now sometimes it feels like the opposite. Something that's small may feel overwhelmingly large because of the way that we consume it. And that is a subjective feeling of chaos and anarchy that may lead to those feelings.
The never-ending bombardment of images and words that are said about events that aren't necessarily... Well, they don't lend the idea that society is cooperative and political leaders are acting the way they should. I'm thinking back to my childhood. There was, 10 minutes a day, 20 minutes a day where Peter Jennings would tell us, would read headlines to us. That was kind of it.
That was enough.
That was it.
And another way of framing that, first of all, do you agree or disagree with that idea? And then secondly, maybe it's just a reminder that the kind of video you were talking about earlier is exactly what we should be going for. Turkeys hugging people and people hugging turkeys.
Thank you, Cindy.
Yeah. Thank you, Cindy. Last thing I have to say here, because I promised last week and I try to deliver on my promises.
Is this Mango?
This is Mango from Australia, who delivered some wine science music to Science Unscripted. And for all of you out there, enjoy.
There was a time when cultivating underneath the vine, going backwards and forwards, up and down, in an old Davy Brown, for weeks at a time. Sign, but in rain, hail, or shine, you're driving around and around. It's kind of nice. You got 891 and a flask, but you can't help thinking about the long list of tasks.
We got to use this for the music at the end, too. I love this.
It's legitimately good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you again to Mango. And I have to kind of say to everyone else out there, please don't take offense when I say this. We do get sent other things sometimes, and I can't promise everyone listening that I'm going to play your music. That was unexpectedly good. I clicked in thinking, what am I about to get here?
Especially given they could only sing about the science of wine, and they turned it into a nice, country jam?
Yeah, about autonomous tractors.
A list of a bunch of stuff to...
And it kind of connects to what we're going into here, which is, it's the idea of new technology taking over something that you used to do yourself, right?
Right. Yeah. The idea of losing our jobs to AI, that is a thing. To deal with this topic right now, we are going to take you back to the dairy farms of Norway in the 1950s to see if there is a lesson that can be learned for what happened there when milking machines began to be used.
Science Unscripted.
Hello, my name is Philip Aga. I'm a professor of economics at the University of Mannheim, and I just recently published a paper on the impact of milking machines on women in Norway.
Can you set the scene for us and for our listeners? What did Norway look and feel like in the 1950s, just after the Second World War?
Okay. I think Norway still was a relatively rural country. I mean, like, urbanization and industrialization happened already during this time period. But I think, like, the large agricultural mechanization happened in the 1950s. And that was actually when I think the Norwegian economy started also to transform much more rapidly. Like, you know, having increased urbanization and having kind of increased jobs in manufacturing and particularly in the service industry.
And in the rural landscape, how many cows were on your average Norwegian farm?
I would say, like, you know, on average, maybe around 7 cows per farm. So I mean, many of these farmers were relatively small.
And then these milking machines, could you milk all 7 cows at the same time with one machine? You just hooked them all up and that was it?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on the feature of the milking machine, but usually you could milk several cows with one machine at the same point in time. And that was where also, like, you know, the productivity gains came in.
Okay, and then once these machines were ubiquitous or were being used by all these farms, then the women who before milked these cows all of a sudden had no jobs. And then they were what? They had to leave the farm, or what happened?
So it depended, of course, who the women were. I mean, like, you know, there were, like, different type of women that were working on this. It was mainly family farms. So some were, like, hired milkmaids. Others were, like, you know, relatives, their own children. But it was a substantial part of their time on these farms was devoted to basically this sort of looking after the cows, milking the cows, and so forth. And then, because of course this job opportunity, or like this kind of job, vanished, they had to look for something else to do. And I think one of the things that happened is that then, like, actually they had more time to go to school, and that is something that in part in our study, like, you know, we are alluding to.
And you're sitting at the University of Mannheim half a century later.
Yes.
And then you've mapped out what these women did then over the next 40 years. And what did you find?
So what we find is that, like, you know, despite that there were this kind of short-term displacement costs, in the long run, we find, mostly driven by the women that kind of were moving out of the countryside, that these women, they kind of, you know, got a better education, they kind of had higher income, and they were also working also later on. They were still in the labor market, and basically this led to a shrinking of the gender gap, not only in terms of labor force participation, but also in terms of the income. And that's what we find.
They instead had the opportunity to educate themselves and pursue a career.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, you know, this kind of leads. So, it depends. But actually what we find is, like, you know, they marry later. So, like, you know, they marry later and they also have then children later. And so, like, you know, this is often, like, associated also with an overall lower number of children in these households, right?
I mean, I know that you don't want to give any false hope to people worried about losing their job because of artificial intelligence, Philip, but do you have any advice to people if they have those fears right now?
Yeah, I think this relates to our results on education. So I think, like, you know, it might be crucial for you, you know, to kind of have some get an education that helps you to kind of be complement to the AI technology. I think this could be very, very helpful in kind of, you know, mitigating the potential negative consequences that the AI technology has on certain jobs.
That was Philipp Auger speaking to us from Baden-Württemberg, Germany, the city of Mannheim, about rural Norway in the 1950s, and it became a tough topic. People are scared right now, and he was looking at what can happen when your job just gets when the rug gets pulled out from under you.
Yeah, I would have to say that's the reason we ultimately decided to conduct that interview, because it makes sense for a lot of the people out there, a lot of our listeners, who are really genuinely concerned about that. It does also have a direct connection to you, Gabe, and your family, which I only kind of half found out a few days back.
When I saw the headline of this study, I could not believe my eyes, because I'm Norwegian. My great grandpa left Norway for the United States, and my great grandma Sinova Moster, this was her job. She milked cows her entire life. And when I saw that there was a study about Norwegian women and cows getting milked, I was like, no way. We have to cover this. Because it literally killed her. Sinova Milster milked her final cow. This was in the United States by now. She left Norway, but worked on a farm in rural Wisconsin, just outside of Deerfield, Wisconsin. Milked her final cow, sat down against the barn, had a heart attack and died. So that I have a connection to this story, and I couldn't imagine the idea of, if we do this podcast, what would Sinova Milster think about this as this topic? I mean, I know that she didn't leave the farm and go to Oslo or Bergen or one of the cities and change her life, but still, I don't know.
It'd be interesting to know what she thought of the technology. In a way, I don't know anything about your family's history, but it kind of sounds like the technology arrived, she fled and went back to what she knew how to do. Maybe in a good way for her.
Her farm in Norway, neither that one nor the one outside of Deerfield used the milking machines. They milked by hand all the way to the end.
So the modern corollary would be a person whose job is taken by AI and they move to a place where it hasn't yet and keep doing what they know how to do. Kinda.
That's what she did, yeah. That would be it. But still, I don't want to make this about me. The topic is about you guys out there, the people who are afraid of their jobs being just taken, disappearing overnight. Because that is coming for a lot of people. And I know that we're aware of it, but do we really think about that a lot? And there are historical examples that we can learn from, and this was kind of one of them.
Maybe. Yeah. Part of it. Part of the story, I think, as Philip said or would say. Do you have any other parts of that story or your own story, your own family's story? Let us know. We're su@dw.com.
Fruit from the vine, fruit from the vine. Let's drink and be merry with fruit from the vine in the morning, in the evening. Harvest is done. Let's drink and be merry with fruit from the vine.
Science Unscripted.
Come, brothers, sisters, and friends, for the time is upon us again. There's no telling what this year will bring. When the days go forever, the nights are getting warmer. A cup runneth over with fruit from the vine. And there was frost in the springtime again.
DW, made for minds.